Champagne is fun. It's diverse. You know, you should play around. You should play around with wine. Challenge yourself. Try new things.
This is the Inside Wine Podcast. I'm Joe Janisch, offering you insider tips to make the right wine decisions. Today, we're talking with champagne expert Todd Lippman, because champagne is not just for celebrations anymore. So, Todd, thank you so much for joining us today.
Joe, it's a thrill to be on board today. Thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely. And I know that you know a little bit about champagne with being in all the things that you've done in the wine industry for the past 20 or so years. And I really wanted to talk to you about how champagne has become more of a celebratory beverage as opposed to something that really can be enjoyed on an everyday basis. And you and I had talked offline and you said something that really struck me. It's kind of funny, but so true. And you said that exactly that, that people think of champagne not as a wine, but as a celebratory beverage, and that you thought that was a travesty. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, champagne, it's somewhat ironic, has started out as a celebratory beverage used to celebrate the coronation of the French kings. But effectively, champagne is very, very unique in the world of wine, particularly when you look at the majority of it in terms of volume is a non-vintage product. It's a blend of several vintages. So it creates ultimately a house style. And that's very, very marketable, where most wines are vintage products and they're subject to vintage variation from any given year. So champagne has really been branded in that way as a luxury product. It's also can be quite expensive. And I think it is a celebratory product. There's no question about that. But it has so much dynamic presence with food that I think people just don't appreciate.
Yeah, I would agree with that. People are usually surprised when I say to them, you know, you can start with champagne and actually end your meal with champagne, depending on what you're eating. It can be such a wonderful wine for pairing with food.
I agree with you 100%, Joe. I agree with you 100%.
You know, you mentioned non-vintage, and that's something that a lot of people don't really quite understand. They might not even realize that a lot of champagnes are non-vintage, and probably the ones that they're usually buying are non-vintage. So talk a little bit about how that actually works. Is it blends of several different years? How many different years can it be? And maybe we can get into that to kind of give an idea of how that works.
Sure. It is typically a blend of multiple years. There are, by definition, obviously. But there's something to be said about a year where a champagne house makes a vintage wine. So because the bulk of any champagne house is going to be their non-vintage cuvée or blend using multiple vintages, they effectively have to pull off and reserve some of the wine from each vintage to be able to create a consistent product by blending that non-vintage sort of house style. And also to be able to continue to push out that volume, which is really what drives the financial capital to run these wineries. You know, your vintage product is being aged anywhere. It's a minimum of 4 years, but typically, can go as much as 10 for your top quality wine in any given winery. But for non-vintage, it's only by law, a minimum of 15 months. They call on the lees, or the secondary fermentation, which is what makes the bubbles. The still wine is fed a little bit of sugar and yeast, and that yeast, in the wine world referred to as lees, really gives a lot of complexity of texture and aroma, adds a little bit of weight to the wine, and it's also what drives up the price. You know, the longer you keep it on the lees, the longer you have to wait to sell the product. So, you know, it's quite the investment in champagne.
Right. It's almost like you're paying the seller to age the wine for you in some ways.
In many ways.
Yeah. So with a non-vintage, again, like people can get confused. So they probably don't realize that champagnes are generally not made as a vintage every year. In fact, it's quite rare. It's only a few times a decade, generally speaking, right?
Yeah, it does vary. Certain houses, I keep saying houses, but, you know, wineries, you refer to them as champagne houses. So I'll probably use that term quite a bit. But I think, you know, some will declare vintage years more frequently than others. Some will, as I mentioned, a top cuvée or the most serious and age-worthy wine that any house might release, that might not be released every year that they release a vintage wine. So that's even rarer. And usually in those years when they don't produce a top wine, or they call tête de cuvée, those vintage wines are even that much better, because usually they're pulling off the best quality fruit to make that tête de cuvée. So it's a good trick to find some better value to quality ratio in vintage wine.
So that's kind of the reason why someone would opt to spend the extra dollars for a vintage, because the grape quality would be better as opposed to in the blend, the non-vintage.
Quality, absolutely. But on top of that, I think particularly if you look at it as a non-vintage as being the flag bearer for any house, your quality is meant to be high. Otherwise, they're kind of shooting themselves in the foot. But it certainly goes to say that a vintage product, whatever is actually labeled as vintage, remember, in any harvest year, which is effectively a vintage, some of that wine is still going into their non-vintage cuvée. So again, the wine that has a vintage label on it has to be aged longer on the lees. So it's going to have a little bit more complexity. It's certainly going to have some specific character that only represents that vintage. So that vintage might be a warmer year, a cooler year, a drier year, a wetter year. So that specific character on top of the winemaking techniques is really what makes vintage champagne quite special. That's not to say that a non-vintage wine is not special. Champagne is special, but it's not precious. It should be used with friends. It should be used with multiple styles of cuisine. You alluded to it. You know, there's no problem doing an entire paired wine dinner with only champagne. There are different styles.
So again, if someone is going to be spending the money on a vintage bottle of champagne, let's say, well, one bottle, forget about that. Let's say a person is going to spend on like investing in like a case or two of a specific vintage of champagne, it might be a good idea to do some research to learn about that specific vintage and get an idea. Or you think it's more about the house style that you seem to prefer? Or what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's always best to start with house style. Effectively, as a vintage product, there's going to be a bit more variation just based upon it's an agricultural product. I mean, it starts as a grape on a vine before it is made into wine. Now, that being said, I was reminded recently by many winemakers giving presentations and all sorts of Zoom tastings, as it were. They refer to it as growing wine, not growing grapes, because it's a very cultivated process. You have to consider how things start and where things are going to end. But in terms of a vintage, yes, there are wines from vintages that should be aged a little bit longer than others. Others that can be enjoyed a bit more readily. But generally speaking, a vintage champagne should be aged a little bit longer than a non-vintage wine.
And this is a question that I've asked before, and I've never gotten the same answer depending on who I've asked. If you have a really nice vintage champagne, does it make sense to cellar it, or are you better off opening it right up?
So again, I think it depends. I get asked this question a lot as a sommelier, not just about champagne, which I realize is the topic at hand, and it's my favorite topic, so I'm going to return to it in just a moment. But I think it really depends on what you're looking to get out of a wine. Generally speaking, when a wine is born or bottled, you know, it's going to have more fruit than it will ever have as it ages, and not all wines age the same. It's going to become a bit more complex and texturally oriented. Some wines that are very rich in tannin that really dry out the mouth really do require quite a bit of time to become palatable and soften up. And as it were with champagne, particularly because of the unique, as I mentioned, lees or yeast contact, which again is by law more significant of a time frame than with non-vintage. Now, of course, elective winemaking, you can age your non-vintage as much as you like before you release it. But yeah, I think you owe it to yourself if you're going to make the investment on particularly champagne. Vintage champagne is generally not inexpensive. And the reward of a little bit of patience certainly pays off with the patience and investment ratio. Yeah. Yeah, definitely worth it.
Okay. Now, here's another simple question that I also get many different answers on, depending on who I ask. Would you recommend drinking champagne out of the typical flute, out of a white wine glass, Sauvignon Blanc glass, paper cup? What is your favorite vessel?
Well, at any given moment, Joe, I'm so passionate about champagne. You know, if I'm going for a walk in a park, I might be drinking it out of a water bottle that I've put the top back on. I may have been known to do that, or maybe I've done it so incognito I've not been known to do it. But generally speaking, I prefer what they call an all-purpose glass, a white wine glass, generally something a bit smaller than, say, a typical Bordeaux glass, or what a lot of people simply refer to as a red wine glass. At the end of the day, as long as you can get it from your hand to your mouth, I'm okay with it. But my preference would definitely be an all-purpose or white wine glass.
Okay. That's what I like, too. I like to... I have a pretty big nose, and I like to be able to have room to get it through the rim so I can actually smell it. And those little flutes usually don't do it for me. Usually the bubbles just hit my nostrils and then I can't actually smell anything.
Yeah. I mean, and it's kind of, the tradition, particularly in service, a lot of people, my main objective, first of all, is I don't have an agenda as a sommelier. If you want your wine in a flute and I have flutes in the restaurant, I will serve it to you in a flute. With pleasure. But I do think that you can not only, depending on the size of one's nose, I think you can really appreciate the complexity and aroma of the wine that much more readily. There's nothing wrong with swirling champagne just a little bit, but effectively releases a little, you shouldn't over swirl, but it definitely releases a lot of the aromas and complexities. Remember, it's sat in a bottle for a very, very long time. So a little bit of oxygen provided by a little bit more surface area, exposed surface area, is going to allow the wine to open up. It's still wine. It still needs oxygen. And it also, in my opinion, I don't think should be served ice cold.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. So more like a white wine, like towards 58 degrees around there?
I think it does. You know, the specific temperature, I think, depends on the style of the wine. I do need to point out that the contents are under pressure. So it is important to get it cold before you open it, or you're going to be wasting a bit of your champagne and cleaning it off of your dining room floor. And it's always better to drink it than to mop it up.
Well, while we're on the subject, I'm glad you brought this up. How should a champagne be opened properly?
So, a couple things. Again, contents are under pressure, so it could be a hazard if you're not opening it properly. The appropriate way is, though there are some fancy, I'm going to define this term, but fancy cages out there that don't allow you to do this, but 99.99% of champagne has a traditional and consistently presented cage, which effectively holds the cork into the bottle because of the pressure. And what you do is keep this in mind. You always need to keep your finger on the cork. It is literally impossible to keep your finger on the cork if you take the cage off. So you want to keep the cage on. It also provides a little bit of grip. So you want to untwist the cage. I personally like to put that little lever that sticks out between my ring and middle finger. And we talked about contents being under pressure. We also indirectly, at least I mentioned the term surface area in this conversation. So what you want to do is you want to point your bottle away from yourself and away from anybody else at about 45 degrees, not temperature, but in terms of an angle. So what that does is it actually enhances the surface area within the bottle, and therefore slightly reduces the pressure. So that's important. You don't really want, listen, get the bottle open, that's fine. But, you know, in a dining atmosphere, you really don't want the bottle to make a loud popping sound. Sometimes it's fun when you're, you know, not in a restaurant. Sometimes it's fun when you're in a restaurant, but from a, you know, a stereotypical service perspective, it's not wanted. So you'll reduce the pressure, and ideally you're meant to twist the bottle back and forth, not the cork. Though some corks are very, very stubborn. So you just want to make sure that you're maintaining control of a firm grip on both ends. Because if you're taking the bottle out of, let's say, an ice bath, and it's wet, you know, you want to make sure you dry it off so you can get a good grip on it.
Yeah. I actually recommend using two towels if you can, if it helps with the grip. Some people just use one or none at all. You know, you said something about when you actually remove the cork, and everyone, of course, wants to hear that ceremonious pop of the cork. And I remember speaking a long time ago to a champagne winemaker, Christian Paul Roger, and he said, when you open the cork, it should sound like a mouse fart. And that's always stuck with me.
I've actually heard that from Christian Paul Roger. So that's
there funny. You go.
We have that in common. Yeah. You know, it also, it slowly alleviates the pressure in the bottle. You know, you can lose a little bit of effervescence. I mean, is it that appreciable or that noticeable? Likely not, but it is just a scientific fact. So it is meant to be done slowly and elegantly. And yeah, it's a magical thing when you open a bottle of champagne.
Yeah, and we definitely don't want to see the cork flying across the room. That is definitely not what we want happen.
Definitely not. Or if you lose a grip on the bottle, sometimes the bottle flies around the room.
Oh, geez.
That's definitely not fun either.
Yeah, that was not good at all. Although if it does happen, definitely capture it and on video and put it up on YouTube because that'd be fun to watch.
They have some crazy champagne mishaps on YouTube. I can guarantee you that.
Oh, boy. So let's talk about what we were sort of touched on a few times already is how champagne can go so well with food. So maybe walk us through a couple of some of the more traditional champagne pairings that you love as well as some things that most people probably wouldn't think about as far as matching champagne and food.
Absolutely. Absolutely. With pleasure. You do, however, need to give a small disclaimer, and that is I don't generally believe there's ever one answer to the question, what pairs best with this?
Sure. I agree.
You know, it depends on taste. It depends on which element of a dish you're looking to highlight. But, you know, if we're talking from a more traditional perspective, you know, there are different styles of champagne. There are different, as they call it, dosage or sweetness levels. There are also, you know, three main grapes used to make champagne. There are a couple others that are permissible, but they tend to be quite rarely found in a bottle. That being said, they result in, and we talked about the aging process and how that affects texture and aroma. So there are always going to be exceptions. And as well, this is a bit of an overgeneralization, but the creamy nature of what they call a blanc de blanc, it means white from whites. So it is effectively not a pink champagne made from only white grapes. And typically that is 100% Chardonnay. That being said, it tends to be a little creamier, a little bit more citrus oriented. So seafood really works great with it. Oysters, shellfish. You know, I would say, particularly as a result of the longer aging on the lees, the wine can get a little bit, you know, creamier. And I think that something a little heartier, like lobster, which has, you know, similar marine-like flavor to the aforementioned items like oysters and shellfish. Of course, it is a shellfish, but it has a richer texture. And so too would a vintage Blanc de Blanc.
Right.
So wine is three-dimensional. You smell it, you taste it, and you feel it. And food is very much the same way. I guess four-dimensional if you want to say you look at it. But at any rate, and that same style of wine, you know, would be great with richer cow's milk cheeses, like a Brie or Camembert, which of course is a style of Brie. I think that richness tends to go with richness, and that creaminess tends to go with creaminess. There's I don't know if it's a trend insofar as it's not trendy. It is just the way things are going. I think a combination of consistent level of quality harvests, a bit more attention and ingenuity in the vineyard, global warming, etc., that quality is quite high. And oftentimes, whether it's based on what nature gives you, or your elective style of what you want to put in the bottle, there are different sweetness levels, as I alluded to. So there's a lot of what they call non-dosage or brut nature these days. And those are bone dry. For me, oysters and that style of wine are phenomenal. Fried food and that style of wine is phenomenal. That acidity, or therefore lack of sweetness, champagne's always going to have acidity. Good wine should always have acidity. Balance of these things is really important. But that acidity is going to help cut through some of the richness of either of those products. But champagne and fried chicken is pretty much the way to go. I mean, if you can put caviar on that fried chicken, you're in heaven. But caviar likes drier champagne. And I think what a lot of people fail to recognize is those are the more traditional
pairings of champagne, but it's really, really diverse. I talked about doing an entire paired wine dinner with champagne. You know, you think about rosé champagne. Rosé champagne is phenomenal with things like salmon, something like venison, pheasants, things like that. Wild game is, you know, happens to be great with rosé champagne. And then,
wow, that's something I never would have thought of. I never would even thought to do, you know, something like a gamey bird or something like that with champagne.
Yeah, that's, and again, you know, we're talking about base proteins here. Now, obviously, the preparation methods of the food and, you know, from a pairing perspective and accompaniments, you know, they all,
of course,
will push you in that direction of, you know, a better pairing. But it's a very, very diverse thing, you know, and you look at the fact that not just flavors, but texture of champagne. It has the bubbles, you know, it has the mousse that helps spread flavor across your palate. It also helps wash your palate. So spicy foods and champagne are actually pretty great. On top of that, spicy foods and high alcohol wines are not generally good friends. So champagne is generally speaking somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, 11 to 12% alcohol. So it's something to consider.
Yeah.
They also make sweet champagnes, so called, you know, demi-sec or doux, as it were. And really, really, it's just, there's so many different styles that I think not every wine list is going to have, not every retailer is going to have. But, you know, if you do your homework and you ask a sommelier, we can help you find something that's going to work for you.
Right. Yeah, I've not really seen, I mean, I've seen demi-secs and other ones, but it seems like the Brut is the one that people will usually find at the retail shop and on most restaurant lists.
Without question. Absolutely. On top of that, there's really three sub-designations of Brut, and I've mentioned all of them in this conversation. So that is a sweetness designation, but it is also a range. So there are Bruts that are effectively sweeter on the palate. I wouldn't designate them as sweet in the broad scheme of things, but we talked about house style. So a particular wine that is designated as Brut may be sweeter or drier than other Bruts. Brut Natur, for instance, is necessarily less than 3 grams of sugar per liter.
Right.
Extra Brut is a broader range at up to 0 to 6. And then Brut itself, which those are all subcategories of, is anything less than 12 grams. So that term, you know, is going to tell you it is a drier product, but there is still going to be a range. And don't be fooled by the fact there is also extra dry. The French are messing with you. Extra dry is actually less dry than Brut.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Is extra dry and extra Brut the same thing, or is that a different term I'm confusing with something else?
They are different terms. So if you look at it as the first category of dry to less dry as Brut, it would go Brut Natur, extra Brut, and kind of that there's a, you know, because less than 3 grams could be zero. But Brut Natur, extra Brut, and Brut from driest to least dry within that series of, you know, in the Brut category. And then extra dry, I believe, is it picks up with an extra 5 at 12 to 17 grams per liter. And then, of course, the French are messing with you again because the word sec means dry. And now that's 17 to 32 grams. So, yeah, it can be a little confusing. And you're absolutely right. You don't tend to find all of these styles, A, on a restaurant wine list, and B, certainly not in your average retail shop, even in your finest retail shop.
Yeah, it can get a little confusing, which is why when people ask me for direction on champagne, I just kind of direct them toward the non-vintage Brut because it seems to be the one that's found most often. And I usually try to tell people, try a couple different non-vintage Bruts from different producers and until you find one that suits you. And then you can kind of dive into all the other different categories if you really want to.
I agree completely. It's the style that people are most familiar with. When they say champagne, that's generally speaking what they're looking for. Absolutely.
And the funny thing too about the whole sweetness, if our listener knows a little bit about residual sugar in wine, some of those numbers may sound kind of high, but what people may not realize is that the acidity of champagne, as with the acidity of any wine, kind of like combats that. So like, if your residual sugar is 12 on a champagne, it's not going to taste the same level of sweetness as a lower acid wine, such as, you know, like maybe a Merlot or something. 12 grams of a residual sugar on a Merlot is going to be taste a lot sweeter.
Absolutely. You know, champagne is, like I mentioned, is always going to have that backbone of acidity. It helps it age. It helps it be, you know, refreshing. Generally speaking, champagne is about as almost as far north as you can go to produce grapes. So it's a very cool climate. So effectively, ripeness, physiological ripeness is attained, but generally speaking, the grapes are picked a little later in the broad scheme of things because it's a high latitude, but a little earlier than if you were trying to attain a higher level of alcohol. Remember, there's a secondary fermentation in bottle. So you're going to gain, you know, off the vine, I believe champagne grapes are harvested with just about a 10% by volume level potential alcohol. And then that secondary fermentation where yeast feeds off sugar is going to produce, you know, generally an extra 2. Now, of course, vintage variation and elective styles dictate that. But yeah, it is always going to be clean from the outset. And then it's elective style of both winemaking and what they call the dosage, or the mixture of reserve wine and sugar that's put in after those lees, that yeast is removed from the bottle.
Got it. Okay, thank you. So while we're talking about winemaking, let's talk about the grapes. So there are generally 3 different grapes that are used to make champagne. I don't know that everyone realizes that who's, you know, maybe not into wine and champagne as much as others like us, the geeks that we are. But you know, there's Pinot Meunier, Pinot Noir, and Chardonnay. And most people don't realize that the red grape, Pinot Noir, actually makes a white champagne, just like a lot of people don't realize a black grape makes Pinot Grigio. But I would like you to talk a little bit about those 3 grapes specifically and why they're used for champagne and why they're grown in champagne. And you talked a little bit about the Chardonnay, the Blanc de Blanc. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about all 3 varieties.
Sure. So each of those 3 grapes happen to be what they call cool climate grapes. They don't take too well to overt heat. Now, that being said, when they're cultivated in what you would think is a warmer place, they're usually at a higher elevation where it tends to be a little cooler, even though you're closer to the sun. But these 3 grapes actually work phenomenally well, not just in a cool climate, but in the soil found in Champagne. So there is a very diverse array of soils, and they change. But there's, generally speaking, a pervasive presence of chalk soil. Remember, this is a cool area, and the chalk soil has great drainage, so there's less potential for fungal disease or rot, mildew, so it can be healthier grapes. But it also retains heat. So this is a very cool area, so this helps to you know, ripen them a little bit more readily, sort of offset some of that overt coolness. But they're delicate grapes, generally speaking, with thin skins. Pinot Meunier is a mutation of Pinot Noir, and so it's kind of in the same family, but they produce wines with different character. Pinot Meunier tends to be on the sort of fruitier side. It's easier to grow. It's a little less fussy. And then Chardonnay provides a certain, you know, creaminess and citrus element. And Pinot Noir provides really great acidity and some berry characteristics. It's worth noting that the juice does have flavor, but the majority of complexity will come from the skins of grapes. And effectively, as you touched upon, you would be having rosé champagne if there was skin contact. So that's where the lees and that whole process of aging on the lees really lends a lot of character. The quality has to be there on the vine, but really, it's really what makes champagne special. That and the bubbles, of course.
Okay. So I happen to represent a nice champagne house called Tattinger, and they're always boasting about the fact that they have a lot of Chardonnay vineyards that they own. What would make it so special that the fact that they have so much Chardonnay? Maybe you could let me know what that is so that I could do my job a little better.
I think it depends on several things. There are different soil types. There are different subzones, different villages within those subzones of Champagnes. Depends where your vineyard holdings are. If you have and correct me if I'm wrong here, Joe, but you know, Tattenjay has very large, they own a lot of their fruit.
Yes.
And their vineyards, and they have a lot of great quality Premier Cru and Grand Cru vineyards.
Yes.
More than most.
Yes.
And the majority of those happen to be in what they call the Côte de Blanc. And so you want to have a lot of Chardonnay in the Côte de Blanc. It is called the White Hillside. So effectively, that's a great place. If you've got a great vineyard land there, you know, you want to plant Chardonnay. It also does help the texture of wine, as I mentioned, just provide a certain creaminess, a certain backbone for extended lees aging. Tattenjay, I know quite well. Their primary non-vintage cuvée, the Brut La Française, you know, I believe sits on its lees for 4 years. And so they have to have the sort of backbone of quality to be able to do that. Otherwise, if it doesn't have the substance in terms of fruit, the base wine, which is always, you know, blended from many different places and many different plots, if it's not high quality, no amount of winemaking is going to fix that.
Right. Thank you. Yeah. And you alluded to something that I completely forgot, which is many champagne houses don't actually own the vineyards. They actually are getting grapes from contracted growers. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that. And it's probably for the best because it doesn't necessarily mean anything bad or good, because I believe most of those contracted growers are contracted for years and, you know, long-term contracts, and there's a lot of oversight and things like that.
Very true. Yeah, it is. You know, I think at the head of the conversation, or at least earlier, I alluded to a sort of house style and major houses. I will tell you, not just because you represent the wine, but Tattenjay does have a very high level of general quality from the base Brut La Française to their tête de cuvée, the Comte de Champagne. And being a big house is not necessarily a bad thing. It depends where you're, either how you're treating your vineyards, if you own them, or your contracted fruit. But if you're a big house, you've been sort of grandfathered in, as it were, through the years to be able to have a large amount of product by purchasing a lot of fruit. And there's been a trend towards those farmers who, you know, supplied and maybe still do supply the big houses to some extent. Most have made their own wine, but it never got exported, particularly into the U.S. And, you know, in the last, I would say, 15 to 20 years to this point, you're seeing more and more of the what they call grower champagne labels. So they might be a little less familiar to the eye, but they're, generally speaking, indicative of a wine that comes from just one place, because that's literally a vineyard that this family has farmed and owns, where the larger houses, I mean, there can be single vineyard designations, absolutely, but generally speaking, those are not representative of a single place. Single vineyard wines are not necessarily better. They simply represent a specific place. So it, you know, just encapsulates the soul of the soil, of the sun, of the fruit, of the toil of a farmer, a particular farmer. So it kind of has a romantic element that I tend to enjoy.
Right. Cool. All right. I think it's time to pop open a cork.
Wait, you didn't pop open a bottle of champagne yet?
I did, but I opened it so quietly, it was like a mouse fart, so you didn't hear it.
Yes. You did a great job.
This was great, Todd. Thank you very much. Really appreciate this.
My pleasure. Thanks again for having me on board.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Todd Lipman. We hope you learned something about champagne, and if you did, please tell a friend. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the Inside Wine Podcast so you can have the next episode delivered to your podcast app automagically. Check the show notes for more information about both Todd and champagne. And in the meantime, please remember that wine is food. It comes from a place. Enjoy it responsibly.